Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
We are 1 week away from President's Day, and you know what that means. Yep, your kids are home from school, banks are closed, no postal service. You might get a 3-day weekend, especially if you're a school teacher, banker, or postal delivery person. And of course, there are great sale prices on mattresses and household appliances. I know, because every owner of a mattress and appliance store around us dresses up like George Washington or Abe Lincoln to hawk their wares this time of year. But we here at Research on Religion don't sell mattresses, although I'm not beyond talking with somebody about corporate sponsorship. But instead, we like to talk about religion, and what better way to get you prepared for all those family get-togethers and neighborhood block parties celebrating the birthdays of Washington and Lincoln than to give you some interesting historical information about how religion has been, or has not been, a factor in electing presidents and guiding the policy direction of their administrations. To help us out, I'm pleased to be joined by Dr. Gary Scott Smith, a professor of history and the chair of the history department at Grove City College in Grove City, Pennsylvania. Professor Smith was the inaugural Grove City College Professor of the Year in 2000, which is quite an achievement given the high caliber of instruction that you receive at that institution. And he was also the 2001 Pennsylvania Professor of the Year as well. Gary is the author of several books on religiosity in American history, including God in Politics, Four Views of the Reformation of Civil Government, The Search for Social Salvation, Social Christianity in America, 1880 to 1925, Faith in the Presidency, Religion, Politics, and Public Policy from George Washington to George W. Bush, which will be the focus of our discussion today, and the recently published book, Heaven in the American Imagination, which looks absolutely fascinating and may well be a topic for a future podcast. As usual, we will provide links to these books and other relevant information on our website, so please visit us and don't forget to help us spread the word about this free educational podcast. It is a great resource for homeschoolers, for college students, or for anybody interested in learning more about religion, so please do us a favor and tell somebody in your congregation about us today. Gary, welcome to Research on Religion.
Tony, I'm pleased to be with you.
Great. Hey, first off, I have to ask if you're in the market for a new microwave oven and if you're going to be heading down to the appliance store for their big President's Day sales.
No, I'm not much of a shopper, to tell you the truth.
Oh, okay.
But I will tell you that last President's Day, I had a chance to go down to Pensacola, Florida to speak to the Gulf Coast Economics Club and talk about the faith of Lincoln and Washington. Looking out my window at the howling snowstorm right now, I'd be pleased to do that again this year.
Yeah. So, hey, that's good to hear, though, that somebody down in Florida is taking the occasion of President's Day to actually, I don't know, focus on the presidents.
Yeah, it's a good thing to do. We had a big celebration here, 2009, a program in conjunction with the 200th anniversary of Lincoln's birth. Mm-hmm. And that was a really interesting time to reflect on different aspects of Lincoln's life and his religious convictions.
Now, does Grove City College do anything else to celebrate President's Day or anything like that?
Not anything particular. Mm-hmm. I noted that we are having a blood drive this year, so maybe that's appropriate in some way, shape, or form.
Okay, but it's going to be warm-blooded, not cold-blooded for the snowstorm, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. All right, let's go ahead and talk about the presidents here. And your book is a summary of the faith of 11 presidents from Washington to Bush. And you cover most of the big names in presidential history, including Jefferson, Lincoln, FDR, and JFK. But before we get into a survey of those figures, I want to ask a more general question about religion and the presidency. You know, because many people would argue that we were founded as a secular nation, or at least we were a country that didn't create an established church. And if you compare that to Europe at the time, that does make us less overtly religious in some respects. In our contemporary times, especially since the series of Supreme Court decisions relying, I would say, tenuously on Jefferson's famous statement about the wall of separation between church and state in his letter to the Danbury Baptist, it seems as if more and more people believe that religion should have little or no role in the election of a president, and or religion should have no place in the day-to-day operations of a presidential administration. So here's my question for you. Why should we be interested in or concerned about the faith of our presidents as citizens?
Well, first I would say that while maybe more scholars and pundits think that religion doesn't have much of a role to play in American history and in American politics, that's certainly not what the American people as a whole believe. And while the new atheism has become more outspoken and strident in its claims and assertions, certainly there's still a very high number of Americans who identify with traditional religious faiths of Christianity and Judaism, and of course a growing Muslim population. So I would say that the reasons that we ought to be concerned about the faith of our presidents would include, first, that religion has been tremendously important in American history. Arguably, the impact of Christianity on America has been greater than that of any other country, despite our lack of having a national established church. We had, of course, several state established churches. We've had a higher level of religious participation and involvement than virtually any other country. We had many settlers, not just in Puritan New England, but throughout the 13 colonies who came here for religious reasons. So that's very significant. And of course, throughout our history, we've had various awakenings, various periods of revival. We've had a strong connection between religion and reform in all periods of history. So there are lots of ways in which religion has informed the American experience and been very, very important here. And of course, we see that commitment in such things as coins and, for a long time, Bible reading and prayer in public schools, the Pledge of Allegiance, the display of the Ten Commandments in public places, chaplains in the military, Congress beginning with prayer, you know, all those kinds of things. Secondly, I think we should note that all presidents, like all other people, have a worldview. They have a personal philosophy. They have a perspective on life that directs their thinking and their actions. And, of course, many factors enter into shaping those worldviews, but certainly their religious convictions have often been very important, and I try to describe that in the book in the case of the presidents I look at. So many presidents have been deeply religious individuals, certainly not theologians, not Bible scholars, but people for whom faith was very significant. And, of course, presidents have used a great deal of religious rhetoric. If you look at their speeches, particularly their most important speeches, you will find biblical allusions, you'll find biblical quotations, you'll find moral language, you'll find concern about religion. And there's a lot of polling data that indicates that American people do care about the religious convictions of their presidents. In fact, there was a recent poll in which 72% of Americans said that they wanted their presidents to have strong religious beliefs. Now, of course, usually they don't want the president to wear his religious convictions on his sleeve or profess to see handwriting on the wall, but they want a president who prays and seeks God's guidance. We've had polls that have repeatedly said that 40% of Americans wouldn't vote for an atheist for president, that a truly secular candidate would have trouble getting elected in the United States. So I think all those reasons are important factors in why we would want to study the faith of presidents.
Yeah, I think that's true. When you think about the characteristics of the American public, you know, we are a church-going nation relative to other European nations or other Western nations. And even though church attendance may have subsided a bit in recent years, people do still profess a belief in God. They're connected to their Christian roots, predominantly Christian nation, or their other faith roots. And so it would just make sense that if you're electing a representative for the entire society, which is what the president is, the constituency is the entire American citizenry, you would want that person to, you know, connect with your worldview.
Well, absolutely. All the data indicates that there's nowhere in Europe where church attendance is even 10% of the population on an average weekend. And certainly in the United States, there's disputes over what the percentage is, but some people peg it as high as 40%.
Let me ask you this, because you're a historian and you've had the ability to survey the entire American experience, and your book covers from Washington to George W. Bush. Has the importance of religion for the presidency in specific subsided over time, or has it increased importance, or have there been ebbs and flows in history in different historical eras that seems to be more important or less important?
Well, certainly that's true. We've had a high level of religiosity throughout our history, but there have been mountains and valleys. There have been periods of revival and awakening, and there have been periods of declension when religion hasn't been as important.
Mm-hmm.
Some scholars trace as many as four different major awakenings that have occurred in American religious history. So during periods of time when religion is more on people's radar screen and they're more interested in religious questions and issues, periods such as, say, the 1950s or even more recently with the resurgence of evangelicalism, you find a greater concern about the faith commitments of presidential candidates and people in government and presidents in particular.
Mm-hmm. Let me just kind of ask this. We're going to go through and survey each of these presidents. And I'm interested about the 1950s and the Eisenhower administration, because there's been often a lot of talk about, well, the 1950s, you get the image of happy days and Fonzie and the families were all great together, but it might not have always been that way. Let me just ask you a little bit about the 1950s. What made the 1950s so spiritually unique?
Well, it was a period of anxiety about the beginnings of the Cold War and fear about our relationship with the Soviet Union, and also fear of nuclear annihilation. But you had a number of factors that came together. You had the emergence of Billy Graham. You had the beginnings of modern evangelicalism with the National Association of Evangelicals and the resurgence of that particular religious tradition. You had Catholicism was booming in conjunction with the increased population in the baby boom, Fulton Sheen. You had Norman Vincent Peale and the power of positive thinking. You just had from all different specters, mainstream, Protestantism, Catholicism, Judaism was doing pretty well during that time. Will Herberg talked about the three major faiths all supporting the American way of life. So there was a great deal of support at the popular level and even at the kind of cultural level, with things like Life magazine portraying religion in a very positive kind of way. You had the National Prayer Breakfast beginning. You had a lot of regional prayer breakfasts. You put the Pledge of Allegiance added under God in 1954. So you had a number of things that came together during that decade to make religion more prominent and important in American life.
Now, let me ask you this. Your book deals with 11 presidents, but if I had to ask you about all the presidents that we've had, which president would you assert had the strongest religious moorings in terms of how they operated their administration?
I would put forth several candidates for that. One would be John Quincy Adams, who was a man who was a vice president of the American Bible Society, who read a couple hours of religious literature every day, who went to three services typically on a Sunday, alternating between Unitarian, Presbyterian, and Episcopalian services in D.C. Secondly, I'd say James Garfield, although Garfield, of course, was shot 3.5 months after becoming president and died 3.5 months later, so it's hard to discern his, you know, public policy influence, but very devout Christian disciple of Christ minister.
Yeah. That's one of the things. That's actually one of the things we found out when my son had to do his fifth grade president report. He picked James Garfield because he thought it'd be a shorter report.
Yeah. Sadly, it would be.
Yeah.
William McKinley, mm-hmm. a very, very devout and committed Methodist. Woodrow Wilson, of course, Presbyterian. This might surprise some of your listeners, but I would put Harry Truman in that category, a Southern Baptist who was trying to create a moral crusade, bringing the moral leaders of the world, Christian and Jewish, even leaders of the world together to try to combat communism and the Cold War. Jimmy Carter obviously fits into this category, and I would end with George W. Bush.
Actually, I want to ask you a little bit about Woodrow Wilson and Harry Truman. If you had asked me who had stronger religious moorings, Harry Truman or Woodrow Wilson. I probably would have picked Harry Truman over Woodrow Wilson. And I guess I'm a little bit surprised as, you know, I think back, okay, yeah, Princetonian guy. What made Woodrow Wilson? Explain that a little bit for me, because he's a character that I don't associate much with religious faith.
Well, Woodrow Wilson was Presbyterian to the core. Mm-hmm. He was raised by a family in which his father was a Southern Presbyterian minister. He himself was a graduate of Princeton at a time when Princeton was still pretty tied to its Presbyterian roots. It hadn't gone down the path of secularization, which would come later. Wilson was a elder in several Presbyterian congregations. He sang in the choir. He was a, of all the presidents, of course, he was the only one that had held a PhD, which he earned in political science at Johns Hopkins. But I would say that he had probably the sharpest political theological analysis, particularly as it pertained to political life, kind of in a Calvinist covenantal theological tradition. Strong reverence for the Bible, wore out several Bibles in his lifetime. Prayer was very, very important to him. I think that his faith was very central to his understanding of justice, his well-known devotion to doing his duty, his willingness to stand by his convictions, some would say, too steadfastly.
Yeah.
Certainly he stressed the sovereignty and majesty and love of God. And I talk in my book about his efforts, along with William Jennings Bryan, to promote missionary diplomacy, that is to try to help shape other countries in terms of being more democratic, which he saw as a biblical pattern. Certainly the American entry into World War One, the Treaty of Versailles, his attempt to get us involved in the League of Nations, all those things were very much driven by his Christian convictions.
Hmm. I guess I need to brush up more on my Woodrow Wilson history. So I just never really I associated him with the League of Nations and the Treaty of Versailles and such, but I just never made that connection to his Princetonian.
He's actually among the presidents that I've written about, one who's had a lot more analysis in terms of his religious convictions because of several other people who've written biographies of him, Arthur Link, John Mulder at Louisville Seminary.
Interesting. So let me ask you this. Who do you think were the least religious presidents in U.S. history in terms of their own personal religious moorings?
Well, of course, that's a tougher call, yeah. And I don't study the ones who are the least religious. But if I had to choose, I would choose probably James Monroe and probably John F. Kennedy. And we mm-hmm. can talk more about Kennedy later if you like. But I would certainly not have included him in the book, except that the election of 1960 was so pivotal mm-hmm. in terms of bringing a Catholic into office, and the fact that his Catholicism was used very much against him during that election.
I'm surprised that you didn't mention Jefferson, because there's so much debate about Jefferson, whether he was a believer, whether he was a deist, whether he considered it seriously, et cetera, et cetera. So let's do a survey of the presidents and that you cover in your book. And, well, I'd like to start at the beginning. I just mentioned Jefferson here. So tell us a little bit about Jefferson and why you didn't put him among that list of the least religious.
Oh, I certainly wouldn't put him in that list at all.
Okay.
The election of 1800, he was accused of being an atheist. He was accused of being an infidel. He was accused of being a supporter of the French Revolution. Federalists literally buried their Bibles in their backyards in New England because they'd heard these rumors of Jefferson was elected president and he was going to take the Bible away from them. So there was obviously a lot of concern about Jefferson's religious belief system at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But I certainly wouldn't put him in that category. He was a man who, before he went to bed every night, he read half an hour of religious or moral teachings, often the Bible. He read the Bible in several different languages because he wanted to try to get different, he thought different languages gave him different understandings of different texts. So he was very interested in religious topics and religious issues. Nominally, he was an Episcopalian. He affiliated with Episcopal churches throughout his entire life. Realistically, I would say he was a Unitarian. He famously called himself a sect of one at one point. That is, his beliefs were unique, idiosyncratic. I certainly wouldn't call him a deist in the traditional understanding of that term, because he believed in prayer, he believed in God's providence in history, And those are things that, you know, traditional deists would repudiate. He's famous, of course, for his Jefferson Bible, which he wrote in roughly 1820, about 90-page discourse on the life and morals of Jesus. That, however, didn't come to public light until well after his death, near the beginning of the 20th century. And he famously cut out portions of the New Testament that were supernaturalistic and that involved miracles and things like that that he didn't believe in. But he strongly believed in Christ's character and Christ's general teachings of morality. So I certainly wouldn't say that he was not a religious man. He just wasn't a Trinitarian Christian individual.
Now, we have covered the topic of the wall of separation on this show in the past with podcasts by Mark David Hall and John Fea. And that issue, or that phrase, I should say, is always associated with Jefferson. So I want to get your take on that, because many people have used that phrase, wall of separation. And first of all, many people actually think it's in the Constitution. It's not, and was in a letter to some Baptists from Connecticut who had written to him asking for some assistance. But many people have taken that, including the Supreme Court, to say, well, Jefferson really wanted to push religion out of civic life, public life altogether. What is your take on that phrase and how Jefferson used it, the wall of separation?
Well, first, you're certainly right in asserting that most people think the phrase is in the Constitution or else don't have any idea where it comes from. And Justice Hugo Black certainly made the phrase famous in a 1947 Supreme Court case when he talked about, you know, he quoted Jefferson's letter to the Danbury Baptists and the wall of separation between church and state, and then went on to say that this wall must be kept high and impregnable. My take on it would be that Jefferson was, of course, trying to explain to the Danbury Baptists why he, unlike both Washington and John Adams, had not declared national days of fasting and prayer. And basically he was arguing that the Constitution did not allow the president to do that. However, Jefferson had done that as the governor of Virginia. And if you look at what Jefferson did while he was president, certainly he was not erecting a high, impenetrable wall between church and state, because he attended religious services that were held on government property, which he authorized the use of the hall of the House of Representatives for church services. You know, Washington didn't have very many buildings at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly he allowed the churches to hold services in Treasury and War Office buildings. He signed a federal law, rather, that allowed tax exemption for churches in the District of Columbia. He approved federal funds to support a Catholic missionary who worked with Indians in Illinois. He provided land to help United Brethren Society evangelize Indians in the West. So there are a lot of things that Jefferson did as president that certainly would go against at least the ACLU idea that religion and government have to be totally separated from one another.
Yeah, one could imagine just the court cases that would erupt today if Jefferson did a lot of those things. And in fact, we can imagine those because many of them have come up.
Absolutely.
Let me go ahead and step back from Jefferson for a minute and go back to our first president, George Washington. Tell us a little bit about his faith.
Well, Washington's faith is very disputed. Certainly on the one hand, you've got people who say that he was a deist in the traditional sense of that term. You've got people who are arguing that he should be seen as someone for whom religion was quite unimportant. And then you've got people on the other side of this scope, like Peter Loback, the president of Westminster Seminary, who's written this almost 1,200-page book called George Washington's Sacred Fire, where he argues that Washington was an Orthodox Trinity-affirming believer in Jesus Christ, and that he had an exemplary prayer life and extensive knowledge of the Scriptures and things of that sort. And so we've got, you know, this kind of two extremes. And actually the idea that Washington is an exemplary Christian was put forth by his first biographer, Parson Weems. It was alluded to in various sermons right after he died. you know, he's been put forth almost as an American Moses or a demigod.
Mm-hmm.
And I take kind of a middle position in that I think that if you want to look at presidents and their assertion that God played a providential role in history, you'd be it'd be difficult to find someone who did that more than George Washington. I mean, repeatedly, as commander-in-chief of the Continental Army and also as president, he thanked God for his providential direction of history, and he strongly stressed that. He also professed to believe in the power of prayer. And while he was president, he attended church, whether in New York or Philadelphia, pretty much every Sunday. On the other hand, he never clearly stated what he believed about the deity of Christ. Like Jefferson, he was a nominal Episcopalian, I mean, in that he worshipped in Episcopal churches regularly. So I tend to say that we shouldn't put forth him being a deist or an Orthodox Trinitarian Christian. I would say that we can't know for sure what Washington believed, but we can certainly look at what he asserted and say that faith was an important aspect of his life.
You said something that piqued my attention here, and it's a question I wanted to return to at the end of the podcast, but I think it's a good time to ask it here. You mentioned that Washington never publicly asserted if he was a Trinitarian Christian or not, and I wonder if that was because he had weak faith, as some may assert, or on the other hand, if he's thinking, hey, that's not the role of the president, or that's not my role as a general. I'm a guy who's supposed to march troops against the enemy army, and I'm a guy who's supposed to run the government, the executive branch of the government, and make sure things get done. I'm not the chief theologian in charge of the United States.
Well, that's certainly true, but I should have said he never privately affirmed faith in the deity of Christ either.
Okay.
In fact, he only has about five or six references to Christ in all the voluminous correspondence that he maintained. He never even called Jesus a great moral philosopher, as Thomas Jefferson did or Benjamin Franklin did.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's just not a whole lot of evidence to go on. But I don't think it was necessarily that he was trying to take a more nuanced or neutral position publicly. I think that privately as well, he just didn't declare what he believed on that particular issue.
Okay, the next president that you address in your book is Honest Abe, Abraham Lincoln. And he's one of the other two guys that we celebrate specifically on President's Day, the other being George Washington, of course. I think of all the presidents that we have had to date, his administration probably faced the greatest challenges that we've ever faced as a nation. So how did religion shape his worldview and his policy decisions when it came to issues such as slavery and deciding whether or not to fight a brutal war against his southern brethren who were all supposed to be part of this one large nation?
Well, Lincoln's faith is almost as sharply contested as that of George Washington's. It's very hotly debated. It's very misunderstood. Like Washington, he attributed what went on in history to God's providence. He proclaimed public days of prayer and thanksgiving as president, but he was also very intensely private in his personal beliefs. So that makes it difficult to know what he believed for sure. He was never baptized. We don't have any record that he ever took communion. He never joined a church. He worshipped a lot in churches, particularly Presbyterian churches, especially when he became president. But he certainly had a thorough knowledge of the Bible. Few other presidents knew the scriptures as well as he did. He was certainly deeply interested in spiritual matters. His speeches are peppered with biblical allusions and references. He certainly had a profound sense of God's presence in his life. And he certainly valiantly strove to follow Christian ethics. So I think all those kinds of things can be said about Lincoln. He had popular prints right after Lincoln died that portrayed Washington receiving Lincoln into heaven with open arms. You know, the saintly father figure, the American Moses receiving the Christ figure, the first great martyr, into heaven. I think what stands out about Lincoln certainly is that he's a person who took from Christianity the idea of, you know, we're sinful, we need to confess our sins, we need to mend our ways, we need to practice charity, we need to seek reconciliation, we need to forsake revenge. So that certainly was a major aspect of how he approached the Civil War and how he had planned to approach Reconstruction had he not been assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we can see his face, obviously, in his second inaugural address. We can see it in the Gettysburg Address. We can see it in a lot of letters that he wrote. His faith was very, very significant. But again, he's certainly not somebody that you would call necessarily a Trinitarian Orthodox Christian. You just can't know for sure. But he was certainly committed to the idea that God's purposes were going to prevail, and we needed to seek out God's will and try to understand what God was doing in history, and recognize that God was going to chastise people for their disobedience. You know, he famously said, you know, both the North and the South prayed to the same God for victory, but they were both misguided in some aspects of what they were doing and practices they were espousing.
Here's a question to ask you about the historian's craft, based upon a statement you just made. You said, we know that Lincoln never took communion. And my first question is, how do we know that? And I there weren't media people following him around all the time, and, you know, back in his days when he was in Illinois. The second question that I have is, do we have any understanding of why he never took communion? You said his religious views were very private, but I'm wondering if there's anything in the record to indicate why that might have been the case.
Well, first of all, we would know that he didn't take communion because he said that he never took communion.
Well, that makes it easy. Yeah, okay.
And, you know, beyond that, there's also no record of his ever taking communion. And by the way, the same kind of thing has been said about George Washington, at least that after the Revolutionary War began, that he never took communion. And there's speculation, of course, about why neither one of them took communion. Was it that it didn't reflect their Christian commitment? They didn't agree with communion? You need to understand that communion wasn't being offered nearly as much in this day and age as it is in many churches today.
That's a good
Anglicans,
point.
For example, only had communion four times a year.
Mm-hmm.
Washington famously left church. They'd have a regular service, and then they'd have a communion service after that, and he famously would leave church before taking communion, or when communion was offered. And sometimes he'd send the carriage back for Martha later to get her because she would stay for communion.
Okay.
He was even reprimanded by one of the pastors in Philadelphia, William White, for not staying for communion. And so thereafter, when communion was offered, he just simply didn't come to church on those Sundays to avoid reprimand.
Yeah, that'll solve that problem of leaving early.
Absolutely. So, you know, we can't know for sure. It may be that they didn't feel comfortable with that kind of public statement. They thought that, you know, their sins were not that kept them from doing that. It's purely speculation on our part in terms of, you know, why someone like Washington or Lincoln would not take communion.
It's interesting that Lincoln would say, I didn't take communion, and I'm not familiar with Lincoln's writings in depth, or at least the in-depth of a historian as yourself, but it's interesting why he would say, I didn't take communion, and then not say why, because if I was sitting in an audience and he made that statement, I would be waiting for that next statement. You know, I don't take communion because, and I'd just be on the edge of my seat for that.
Well,
he never said that.
More of a passing reference than, you know, any kind of discourse on the nature of faith.
Okay, well, that's kind of interesting. Well, let's go ahead and fast forward to the 20th century. Most of your book deals with the presidents in the 20th century, and two of them that you address are somewhat surprising to me, in that I really don't associate either of them with any particularly deep-seated faith, and that's the two Roosevelts, Teddy and Franklin. So tell us about the faith of these two gentlemen.
Okay. Well, I think that most scholars, anyway, would be less surprised by Teddy's faith than Franklin's.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly neither one of them have had much written about the nature of their faith. Teddy Roosevelt grew up having a very religiously devout father, joined a Dutch Reformed church when he was 16 years old, taught at a mission in New York City for 3 years when he was in high school, taught Sunday school at an Episcopal church in Cambridge when he was attending Harvard, had a very thorough knowledge of the scriptures, used all kinds of biblical allusions in his speeches, very faithfully attended church most of his life. When he was president, there wasn't a Dutch Reformed church in Washington, so he attended a German Reformed church, but he He went to it regularly. He even wrote a pamphlet one time that was sponsored, I think, by the American Bible Society to encourage people to attend church. He was one who had great interest in theological matters. He scrupulously kept the Sabbath day, didn't hunt or fish on Sundays for religious reasons. Of course, he was connected with the social gospel movement, and after his presidency, he wrote for a leading social gospel publication. He wrote articles for it. He's strongly known, certainly, for emphasizing the importance of Christian morality and character, even the importance of good works. He talked a lot about good works. I argue that you can connect his faith to many different public policies that he espoused, but in my book, I look at three of them in particular. His work to reconcile and resolve a coal strike in 1902, his work in terms of obtaining the Panama Canal, which, of course, many people have faulted him for, and mm-hmm. we eventually did some apologies for what he did, and then his work in conservation. He really saw the president as the steward of natural resources, and he should be managing them on behalf of all Americans and thinking about the future.
I could see the conservation angle of him, the stewardship of God's earth, of God's domain, being very important. So I could see that. But the Panama Canal, explain that one.
Well, I think in this case, it's probably more rationalization
mm-hmm.
than theological reflection. But, of course, he argued that we engineered a revolution in Panama to get the right to build the canal. Panama was under the control of Colombia at the time. And he argued that Colombia was oppressing Panama and that the Panamanians wanted to become independent, and that we were aiding and abetting that move toward independence and a separate government and society there. And indeed, we did do that. The question is, did we have the right to interfere in the affairs of Colombia? And we eventually gave them $25 million as compensation for those actions. And he argued that there were great, you know, benefits that would come to the world through the building of a canal, because you wouldn't have to go all the way down around the tip of South America. You could greatly decrease the amount of time for trade, and so he saw that there were important benefits that that came from this. So that was essentially the argument. He said American actions accorded with the highest standards of international morality, and he was that Colombia had was operating what he called a bandit morality, and he thought the United States had been very generous in terms of how we eventually treated Panama, but also how we operated in this situation.
Mm-hmm. And what about the coal strike? I couldn't imagine that he's counting on Christian reconciliation as a spiritual guide for solving this issue. What happened there?
Well, what happened was that you had about 140,000 miners in north central Pennsylvania who were striking to obtain higher wages, an 8-hour day, union recognition. And, of course, this was a time when unions were not well received by many Americans, and certainly striking wasn't thought of very positively by many people in the American public. And people in mines and the steel industry and other places were working these incredibly long hours under dangerous conditions. So he really tried to look at the perspective of both the United Mine Workers and the owners of these coal mines, and tried to get them to see each other's position and tried to work out some type of fair solution that would please both parties and avoid violence. And so I think that he did a really good job in bringing these two parties together and getting them to resolve their differences. And you know, he was famous for his mediation. He helped mediate the end of the 1904 war between Russia and Japan. He also helped mediate a dispute that changed the rules of football in 1906 by bringing together the major football powers and trying to reduce violence within the sport of football.
That I did not know of, and I am a large football fan. Maybe we can bring him back so that they can move the kickoff back 5 more yards, or you know.
Perhaps.
Okay. Yeah, okay. Let's go ahead and talk about the other Roosevelt, FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, because, again, here's another president that I don't associate with religion very much. And it's not necessarily because they're not religious, but it's because we don't hear very much about it. So tell us about FDR.
Well, FDR is a very interesting case. He grew up as an Episcopalian, and his entire presidency, he served as the warden of the St. James Episcopal Church, this small congregation in Hyde Park, New York. Now, the warden is kind of the senior lay position in the Episcopal Church. He was one of two wardens for this church. And he never made any political capital out of it. Hardly anybody knew it, which was striking because he made political capital out of just about everything else he did and said.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of surprising. He led a worship service on Easter Sunday, 1934, on an American ship for American British soldiers. He preached a sermon. He held a famous worship service with Winston Churchill in 1941 when they were signing the Atlantic Charter off the coast of Newfoundland. He was very famous for his prayers. He included prayers in many of his addresses. His most famous prayer was the D-Day prayer right after the D-Day invasion had begun. He has a 6.5-minute prayer, and obviously you can go on the Internet and hear the prayer. But he had a great appreciation for the Bible. He had services before and on the anniversary of all his inaugurals. He urged Americans to pray. He had great appreciation for the Bible. I certainly put him in the liberal Protestant tradition. He accentuated the need for spiritual renewal, social justice. Like a lot of other presidents, he was convinced that God directed the universe. He really saw a lot of spiritual aspects to the New Deal. It wasn't just about meeting people's physical needs. It was trying to address some of their spiritual concerns. In fact, I have a section in the book where I talk about this letter that he sent out to 120,000 clergy in 1935, basically asking them what they thought of the New Deal and trying to solicit their opinions about what the New Deal entailed and how he could be doing it better and what their ways to improve it. And he also saw World War II as a religious crusade. He thought that Hitler was determined to try to destroy Christianity in the world, and he had part of what the Nazis were trying to do was a plot to exterminate Christianity. And so he cast World War II as a religious crusade pretty much the way that some of our other presidents like Eisenhower and Reagan cast the Cold War as a religious crusade.
Mm-hmm. Let's go ahead and fast forward then to the 1950s. Let's finish with World War II here and go to Eisenhower. And Eisenhower is another one of these figures that I associate. He's a military guy. He's very straightforward and, you know, get to it type of individual. But again, I don't hear very much about his faith. Tell us about Eisenhower.
Well, Eisenhower's faith is very interesting because he grew up in Kansas, and his parents were River Brethren, which is a pacifist tradition. And then they later, when he was in his teenage years, became Jehovah's Witnesses, which you rarely hear anything about, who are also pacifists. There's no evidence that Eisenhower himself embraced the Jehovah's Witness faith, but he remained more, I think, influenced by the River Brethren. But despite those things, he went to the, to West Point, mm-hmm. for his military and college training. Faith wasn't a major part of his life until World War II, and I think the pressure of being the supreme commander of Allied forces in Europe and having to make that D-Day decision and commit all those men to invade and not knowing what the weather conditions were going to be for sure. He talked about that in terms of how he really felt God's presence in all of that. And then he didn't actually join a church until about 3 weeks after he became president. He joined the National Presbyterian Church in Washington, D.C. He was baptized for the first time. He strongly promoted prayer. Believed that God directed the universe. He thought there was a very, very close link between religion and democracy. As we've alluded to, 50s were called piety along the Potomac in Washington because there was so much emphasis on spiritual renewal. And he and FDR both strongly, repeatedly said that America needed spiritual renewal. They said that in countless addresses, that spiritual renewal was essential to the success of American society. I talk in my book about how his faith informed his desire to improve civil rights, and of course the 1957 Civil Rights Act was enacted while he was president, and I also talk about his concern for peace. And while he's perhaps known as a cold warrior, he did a lot in terms of promoting peace, and maybe most famously in his farewell address where he talked about the military-industrial complex.
Mm-hmm. The one policy that I think most frequently of when I hear the word Eisenhower, and one that I am most grateful of because I'm a driver, is his creation of the interstate highway system. So was it possible that that was guided by any kind of spiritual faith like Manifest Destiny?
It may be. It's not something I explored, so
okay.
I'm not going to comment on that.
I thank God every time I'm driving across the United States for the interstate freeway system and Flying J truck stops. So,
absolutely.
John F. Kennedy. Now, earlier on in the podcast, you said you would put him on as one of the least religious presidents. And that's interesting because, again, as you mentioned, the 1960 campaign, he is the first Catholic that has a serious chance of winning office here in the United States. And so Catholicism becomes a big issue. And we associate JFK with Catholicism all the time. Tell us a little bit about John F. Kennedy and why you would have put him as one of the least religious presidents.
Well, I would say that he was religiously devout in the sense that he went to Mass regularly.
Mm-hmm.
I think he did it a lot. For the main reason he did it, I think, was to please his mother.
Mm-hmm.
So that was part of his life. But it's very, very difficult to find any kind of connections between his personal faith and his philosophy of governing or his policy positions. I mean, I searched very long and hard to try to find things, and others have as well, and really there's very little to be found. I talk about the Peace Corps, not surprisingly, in the book, but even there it was mainly his brother-in-law, Sergeant Shriver, who was the mover and shaker behind the Peace Corps, and Kennedy was kind of dragged reluctantly along with that new organization. And certainly as president, he bent over backwards to not favor Catholics, and Catholic leaders really concluded that they probably would have been better off had Nixon been elected, because Kennedy was so adverse to any policies that would even hint of favoring Catholics, like aid to parochial schools or something like that. So it just wasn't, obviously there's a rich and strong Catholic moral and theological tradition, but it wasn't something that Kennedy espoused, and it wasn't part of his personal philosophy of life. I would say he was much more of a pragmatist in terms of how he approached political life and policy.
Let me sidestep here for a moment and ask you a methodological question, because you just mentioned that you found it hard to find references between his personal convictions and his policies. How do you go about finding this stuff? Did you read all of his personal papers, and what's the method of historical research that you undertook to do this project?
Well, in looking at the lives of presidents and their faith, you read all the biographies about them and try to assess what other historians, political scientists, and others have said. I went to the presidential libraries of all my subjects, and I did extensive research in the archives there and looked at what various... they would have files pertaining to religious matters, and of course you could read their personal correspondence as they related to people who were religious leaders. And of course you look at what other people said about them, and then I picked some key issues that I thought might be most likely to where their faith would be able to be seen, and then I did a careful analysis of those issues and tried to look for any kind of faith connections. I also tried to specifically ferret out what their philosophy of government might be. And you know, it's not just me. It's Thomas Carty, who has written a religious biography that came out after my book on Kennedy. It's others who've tried to find these connections and have struggled to do so as well. So, again, there's voluminous literature about the election of 1960 and concerns about what control the Pope will have over American society if Kennedy becomes elected, and mm-hmm. crusades of Protestants to try to deny his election, and the role of Catholics in voting for him as the first viable Catholic candidate. things of that nature. But those are the kind of methodological steps that I used.
On the next step, let's take it up to Jimmy Carter. Now, Carter is oftentimes associated with one of the least successful presidencies in U.S. history. He's telling us to wear sweaters and talking about the economic malaise that we're in and just to basically get used to it. But Carter is an interesting character, given that he comes from this evangelical background, and he was able to get elected because essentially he was not associated with any of the mess that Republicans left behind in the Oval Office, and I'm here referring to Nixon and Watergate. And it's also more interesting that Carter then lost out to Ronald Reagan, who picked up substantial evangelical support with the rise of the Christian right. So there seems to be this very interesting inflection point here in American history in terms of how the political religious landscape took shape for the next decade to come. So explain the religiosity of Jimmy Carter.
Well, Carter was a Southern Baptist who talked extensively in the 1976 campaign about being born again, certainly sending reporters and pundits scrambling to figure out what that term meant and why anyone would use it. He had previously been governor of Georgia, and before that time, he had had a soul-searching period of time when he first lost a race for governor, when he had re-examined his faith. He had a sister who was an evangelist. He became more devout in his faith. He went on preaching missions to various places. So he was someone for whom faith was integral to his life. He was famous for teaching Sunday school much of his adult life. And, of course, a lot of things he's done post-presidency have been directly connected to his faith as well. I wouldn't be quite as negative about his presidency as perhaps you are. I've looked at a lot of literature that says that no one would have done a very good job as president from 1977 to 81, given where we were as a culture and the aftermath of Watergate and Vietnam, and also because of the world economic issues pertaining to oil and things of that nature. But regardless, I think that he was someone who really did try to live out his faith, famous, of course, for his concern about human rights. And that was very closely connected to his faith commitments. I think that it's not surprising that Reagan was able to recapture the evangelical and conservative Christian vote in election 1980. I think that people had gravitated toward Carter because he was so outspoken about his faith, but once they truly understood what his policies were, they were not as in accord with where most conservative Christians were. Certainly Reagan's were much more consistent with what conservative Christians espoused on areas such as abortion, tuition tax increases, or tuition tax credits, just the kind of social conservatism relating to taxation and things of that nature, prayer in schools and things of that sort. So I think that Carter was really the anomaly in terms of getting evangelicals and conservative Christians to support him. He did better in that regard, at least in the 1976 election, than any of his successors have done. And I think Carter blew it to some degree because he made some promises in 1976 that he would give evangelicals some prominent positions in his administration he didn't follow through with, and he didn't even appoint a religious liaison until the halfway through his presidency. He didn't really reach out to religious groups very effectively. So he made a lot of tactical mistakes, but certainly Reagan's philosophy was much more consistent with where evangelicals were.
Let me ask about those tactical mistakes, because that's somewhat surprising. If you know, he is a person who is coming at a time in American history, the mid-1970s, where there probably is a need for spiritual renewal. We just went through Watergate, and Nixon was a huge disappointment for a lot of people. I mean, he could have really captured the evangelical vote and the evangelical support by doing simple things early on in his administration. You say he didn't. Is there any reason why he didn't? He just forgot this, or what?
I think he assumed that because he was so outspoken about his faith, that he would continue to have the support of evangelicals, and religious conservatives, other religious conservatives, and he didn't make it a pattern to work for it. He ended up with a religious liaison in 1978, a guy named Robert Maddock, basically because Maddock pursued him and talked him into employing him for that purpose. He also had a strained relationship with Billy Graham. He really didn't have a very cordial relationship with him, unlike a lot of his predecessors and successors. So I just think that that Carter made some faulty assumptions that people would support him because they knew how religiously devout that he was.
Mm-hmm. And then your next chapter addresses Ronald Reagan and his use of John Winthrop's imagery of America as a city on a hill. Tell us about Reagan's religiosity.
Well, Reagan by the time he became president, a very religious man, mostly Christian orthodoxy.
Mm-hmm.
He grew up with a very devout mother, Nell, Disciples of Christ tradition. He had graduated from a Disciples of Christ college, Eureka College in Illinois. And then he kind of had a period when religion wasn't very important to him when he was doing his movie acting, and really didn't come back to much involvement in the church until the 1960s. And then it was Presbyterianism out in L.A. And then, of course, when he became governor of California, in those 2 terms he spent there, his faith was more important to him, and he was much more involved in Christian participation. But by the time he became president, and of course the election campaign certainly played a role in sensitizing him to religious issues and leading him to think about how faith affects policy. But one of my colleagues, Paul Kenger, has written a religious biography of Ronald Reagan. He really shows that when Reagan was doing radio programs in the 70s, he was already elucidating a lot of the things that became important to him during the presidency, and that he was already making these religious connections. Reagan was convinced that God wanted America to be a beacon of hope and freedom and faith and democracy, that city on the hill you referred to. And that was certainly characteristic of what he did while he was president. And so one can see, I think, lots of different connections between his faith and his policies. Certainly the fact that he survived the assassination attempt very early on in his presidency. He brought in religious leaders. He talked to them. I think he recommitted himself to God at that point. Like a lot of other presidents, he had a deep faith in the value of prayer. He frequently cited the Bible. In fact, it would be hard to find too many other presidents that cited the Bible more than he did. He was convinced that our success as a nation was dependent upon our relationship to God. And, of course, he's known for his opposition to abortion. He even wrote a book on it in 1983. Attempt to pass a school prayer amendment, tuition tax credits, and, of course, maybe most famously, the battle against communism, the Soviet Union as an evil empire, and the importance of religion in the Cold War.
Now, one could definitely see there's a providential belief going on here, at least his view of America. Would you say that his beliefs in terms of the providential nature of America were similar to Washington's, greater than Washington's, or Lincoln's?
I would say that all three of them had similar beliefs in this regard. I think that perhaps Lincoln, of the three, was more critical of what God's relationship was to America, whereas for Washington, and particularly Reagan, they saw God more as blessing America and maybe weren't as judgmental about the practices of Americans. But I think there were certainly some similarities in terms of how all of them saw America's role in the world.
Now, one person you don't deal with in your book to any significant length is Bill Clinton. You skip from Reagan to Bush and George W. Bush in your final chapters. However, I'd like you to reflect upon Clinton a little bit. It seems that everybody knows that George W. Bush really took his faith seriously and brought it into his policy visions, and oftentimes being critiqued because of that. However, a number of scholars have pointed out that Clinton used God talk in his public speeches more than Bush did. And in light of the shenanigans with Monica Lewinsky and others before his presidency, I really get the sense that Clinton's God talks seems to be manipulative and cynical. And what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I left Clinton out of my first volume for the same reason I left Nixon out.
Mm-hmm.
And that was because I thought it was going to be very difficult to talk about the genuineness of the faith that these two men professed. However, I am working on a second volume, and I have gone now to the presidential libraries of both of these individuals, and I've actually written the chapter on Nixon. I'm still in the early stages of writing the chapter on Clinton. So I'm not as prepared to speak on this subject. Ultimately, we can't know the heart of any individual. Only God knows people's hearts.
Mm-hmm.
Clinton did use a lot of religious rhetoric, certainly more than George W. Bush. And like any president, he used religious rhetoric to win votes, to promote his policies, to gain support. I don't see that in and of itself as particularly manipulative or cynical. I think it's just part of the arsenal of weapons that a president employs, and mm-hmm. he knows that certain kinds of language and certain kinds of arguments are going to resonate with the American people. Yeah, religion can be, and it is often used as a tool. It has been in history, and that's sad. I guess I would look at Clinton and Nixon, for that matter, as rather bifurcated. Yes, you could say they were major hypocrites. Yes, you could say they were major sinners. The difference, of course, is Clinton said he was a sinner. Nixon never did.
Yeah.
But we're all sinners,
right? Right.
So I think there was a genuine element to his faith as he grew up as a Southern Baptist in, you know, Hope and Hot Springs, and he was connected with the Southern Baptist Church in Little Rock. I've actually had some conversations with Rex Horn, his pastor, while he was there for 10 years, including the 8 years of the presidency. And, of course, you know, famously, after he had his problems with impeachment, he brought in, you know, religious counselors, including Tony Campolo, to talk about his need for repentance and how to get his life back in shape.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think that there's an aspect of Clinton, and I've read a lot of his speeches that he's given, and I think that he probably did, in terms of social justice issues, derive that from Scripture in large part, because that's how he'd been trained. And, of course, mm-hmm. he went to Georgetown, and he was exposed to Catholic moral philosophy there. So I wouldn't say that it's all disingenuous. I wouldn't say that it's all blatant hypocrisy. But obviously he knew how to hold a big Bible and get a photo op and smile for the cameras. There's no doubt about that. But I think, you know, every president can be accused of using religion to some extent to mm-hmm. encourage support for policies or to make himself look more favorable.
Did Nixon do that a lot? Because my image of Nixon was that he swore a lot. He was a realist president. He deleted some audio tapes, and he controlled gas prices.
Well, Nixon, of course, was famous for having his services at the White House.
Yeah,
he had his religious services at the White House when he brought in people, Billy Graham and lots of other famous American preachers and orators to speak. Nixon used quite a bit of religious rhetoric, too. And of course, he had a Quaker background, and that background was important to him in some regards. I think that there's some real dark side to Nixon's personality and to his actions, and he was manipulative, and he was certainly vulgar, and he certainly was anti-Semitic. So there are certainly some things to be that were very, very negative about Nixon. And yet, on the other hand, if you read some of his personal letters when he's kind of off the record, you see maybe there's a glimmer of real spirituality there. And again, I can't reconcile those things.
Yeah. We're all complicated individuals.
We are.
So you're writing a new version of this book. Are you planning?
Well, I'm dealing with another set of 11 presidents.
Oh, another set. Okay. I'm curious if the Obama administration is going to be included in there, and if you could share any thoughts you have on there, whether or not you're going to include it.
Yes, I'm going to talk about Obama. Tentatively, it's John Adams to Barack Obama.
Okay.
If Obama doesn't win in 2012, I might have to rethink the last chapter.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I'll certainly include him either way, because I've done a lot of work on him, and he's a fascinating case.
Tell us about it.
He's the first American president who wasn't raised in an explicitly Christian family. He had a very eclectic religious background between his mother's skepticism and secularism, and of course his stepfather's Muslim faith in Indonesia. And of course, that's led a lot of Americans to connect him incorrectly, obviously, and it's kind of a sad commentary on where a lot of people are, that they would 20% of Americans might still think that he's a Muslim. Because he's been very explicit in his faith, in speaking about his faith. In fact, I don't know there have been too many candidates other than a Jimmy Carter and a George W. Bush in American history who've talked about their faith journey more than Barack Obama did in the 2008 election. I mean, he repeatedly told his story of how he came to faith and what his faith meant to him. I think he's been a little bit more reluctant to talk about that since he's become president, or at least he's not done it as much, except at maybe the National Prayer Breakfast and a couple other special prayer breakfasts that he's held for Christian leaders. But I think that there's certainly a faith component to Barack Obama.
And so that is a chapter that is still being written, and we are now progressing through the Republican primary season. And I should note that we are recording this on January 13th, and that's before the South Carolina primary, and we will be airing this after January 13th, or actually it will come out on February 13th. And my question for you is that Mitt Romney at the present time seems to be the odds-on favorite to win the Republican presidential nominee. And you're not a Mormon, I'm not a Mormon, and various evangelicals like Bill Keller have come out adamantly opposed to a Mormon being elected. Do you think this is going to be a problem for Romney, given your, you know, view of how religion has played out in the presidency over the past 200 or so years?
I think that he will not probably fare as well among evangelicals as certainly George W. Bush did because of his Mormonism. And I think, again, if you ask people in the abstract, would you vote for a Mormon for president, more of them would say yes than if you gave them a choice between a Mitt Romney and a Barack Obama, and you said, you know, what are you more concerned about, someone who's a Mormon but generally social conservative, or, again, from an evangelical perspective, someone who seems to be promoting various socialist policies and is a proponent of big government. I mean, the telling example for me is if you go back to 1980 and you ask evangelicals in the abstract, you say, would you vote for a candidate who's divorced and who's been an actor in Hollywood? I bet a lot of them would have said, no way.
Yeah.
And yet they voted for Ronald Reagan in droves. So, you know, I think there's that concern. A high percentage of Americans, I think I said 40%, said they wouldn't vote for an atheist. But right now Australia has a prime minister, Julia Gillard, who is an atheist, an outspoken atheist. And obviously Australia is not as religious a culture as ours. But she was able to win election, at least in a nominal Christian culture there. So I think Mormonism will cost him some votes, but I don't think it'll be the decisive factor by any means.
I think, you know, potentially if he does get elected, if he makes it through the primary season and does win election, is this going to be a Mormon moment in many ways like John F. Kennedy had the Catholic moment in presidential history?
Well, I think it'll certainly be a positive thing for Mormonism. It'll certainly help bring it more into the mainstream. I think what's going to happen in the election campaign is that evangelicals who've been somewhat critical of Mormonism on theological grounds are probably going to appeal to the idea that Mormons have very strong families and they're very morally oriented people and they do a lot of good things in society. So I think we'll hear that side of Mormonism a lot more. So I think Mormonism is probably going to gain a lot more positive than negative publicity out of the campaign of Mitt Romney as a candidate. And I don't see Romney's policies as very much informed directly by his faith. Maybe, you know, in the mix of things, his general worldview and understanding, but I don't think that it's a real strong connection with Mormonism as I've read about his biography and looked at his background. And again, I haven't done extensive research on him at this point.
Well, let me go ahead and close with a observation that I've noticed of myself. I guess this is more of a self-reflection comment. As we've gone through here, I really kind of understanding the high level of ignorance I have about the religiosity of our presidents. And, you know, some of the things have surprised me. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, I wouldn't have necessarily associated him with more religious character. We hear a lot about his New Deal and World War II and the Great Depression, et cetera, et cetera. And not so much about his religious faith. And I'm wondering if you could reflect upon why, maybe personally, why I don't know much about it, or why perhaps our country doesn't know as much about the history of the religious history of our presidential presidents.
Well, there's been very few avenues through which one could learn about this until very recently. When I started research on this first book in the year 2000, I counted three books that I could find that dealt in any major way with the religious faith of presidents, that were not just, you know, very, very superficial, try to do all the presidents and three pages each and just mention some very, very minor things about them in passing. And there just haven't been analyses of the faith of presidents by the major biographers of these presidents. So there really hasn't been much avenue by which you could learn about them. Now, in the last 12 years, or maybe more the last 6 or 7 years, there have been a lot of things that have come out. Not only my book, but there have been several religious biographies of different presidents. There have been several edited collections about the faith of different presidents. I've contributed to several of them. Christianity Today has done some things on this subject. So there's just a lot more information available today for those who are interested in checking these things out. And again, you know, having a campaign like the one we're in now, where you've got, you know, two Mormons, two Catholics, and two at least generally Texas evangelicals running, and of course Bachman dropping out, who had a lot of things to say about her own faith commitment. We're in an extraordinary time, so I think that's maybe calling people's attention to this issue.
Well, I think many people could learn a great deal more about this, and I again refer them to your book, Faith and the Presidency, Religion, Politics, and Public Policy from George Washington to George W. Bush. And we have been talking today with Gary Smith. Gary, thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Tony, it's been my pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.